Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today we have a special report on Russia launching war in the Ukraine, including reactions from world leaders and our local congressional representatives. We also have an update from Public News Service on sanctions and NATO's response to the crisis. In local news, hear about a child kidnapping in Spring Valley, a report on just how much snow fell across our region, and why Santee's City Council denied a permit for a gas station, car wash, and mini-mart linked to the Colosio family. Hear why some Californians may be losing access to medical care as pandemic extensions run out. And hear how you can volunteer to help trauma victims in our region. We'll also have news about a new freshwater swimming lake coming to Lakeside on Green Scene. Then we'll have reports of our inquiry to the San Diego Sheriff's and District Attorney on whether they're using DNA from rape kits to solve other crimes. San Diego supervisors have enacted a measure related to the state's new vehicle miles traveled fees for developers, and we'll have details on how that could impact unincorporated areas. It's Children's Dental Health Care Month, and we'll have a report from California News Service. Then, learn why the California State University's chancellor has resigned on our education report. And finally, we'll be airing one of our Best of East County favorites today, taking you on the road to the historic Gold Rush town of Julian. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. In the greatest military threat to Europe since World War II, Russia has openly defied international law and launched a full-scale attack on the Ukraine, a democratic nation on Russia's borders. Russian President Vladimir Putin earlier denied reports that he planned to invade, then created a pretext for military action by recognizing the independence of two Russian separatist-sympathizing regions in eastern Ukraine. The U.S. and prominent European leaders characterized that tactic as a false flag operation. But the attack has gone far beyond the separatist regions, including missile attacks on the capital, Kyiv, military targets, and other cities across Ukraine, such as Odessa. Russian troops and tanks are advancing on three sides of the Ukraine, and they have also reportedly seized the Chernobyl nuclear plant, site of the 1986 nuclear disaster, and are holding staffers there hostage. Volodymyr Zelensky, Ukraine's president, called the Russian invasion a declaration of war against the whole of Europe. U.S. President Joe Biden, in a press conference on Thursday, warned that he believes Putin's ambitions extend far beyond the Ukraine.
You heard the speech he made, almost an hour's worth of speeches, why he was going into Ukraine. He has much larger ambitions in Ukraine. He wants to, in fact, reestablish the former Soviet Union. That's what this is about. And I think that his ambitions are completely contrary to the place where the rest of the world has arrived.
On this point, San Diego's Republican Congressman Daryl Issa agrees. Issa said of Putin's recent speech extolling Russian history, quote, he was giving us his map for rebuilding the entire empire. According to Issa, Putin was suggesting that the Czech Republic, Poland, Yugoslavia, and other countries could be taken over next. And he adds, clearly, this is his ambition. Issa called Russia's attacks a disastrous day for free nations everywhere and a direct assault by tyranny and aggression that will compel the world to take notice. And he says this is also a defining moment for the Biden administration, which he accuses of failing to bolster a coalition of allies and partners to keep and secure the peace. President Biden has announced sanctions against Russia, including a freeze on Russian bank assets totaling $1 trillion, a ban on Russian imports of U.S. technology, a freeze on assets in banks based in Belarus, a Russian ally, and sanctions against individual Russian elites, cronies of Putin. Biden also imposed sanctions on the company overseeing the Russian-owned gas pipeline Nord Stream 2. The European Union and some European nations have also imposed sanctions, including restricting Russia's access to capital and trade in European markets. Germany's chancellor has halted permission for the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline from Russia to Germany to open. In an emergency meeting of the United Nations Security Council Wednesday night, Ukraine's ambassador asked the UN for help to stop the war and condemned Russia's actions. He called on Russia's ambassadors to step down from chairing the meeting, a request that the Russian ignored, continuing to preside over a session in which Russia retained veto power over any actions. The Ukrainian ambassador fired back this response to Russia's ambassador.
There is no purgatory for war criminals. They go straight to hell.
Germany's ambassador accused Russia of violating the core principles of the United Nations Charter with unprovoked military actions, and she added,
"Now is the moment to speak up and defend the international order of the UN Charter against unilateral aggression, jointly and decisively. Tonight we stand with Ukraine, and we are doing so unwavering and determined."
The U.S. ambassador denounced Putin for delivering a message in total disdain of the United Nations, dropping bombs even as the Security Council met. And she added,
"As President Biden said tonight, Russia alone is responsible for the death and destruction this attack will bring, and the United States and our allies and partners will respond in a united and decisive way. The world will hold Russia accountable."
Ironically, while world leaders almost unanimously condemned Russia's actions, including leaders in both political parties in the U.S., former President Donald Trump praised Putin for recognizing separatist regions in Ukraine just hours before the invasion began. In an interview with conservative media at Mar-a-Lago, Trump said,
"Putin declares a big portion of the Ukraine, Putin declares it as independent." Oh, that's wonderful. So Putin is now saying it's independent, a large section of Ukraine. I said, how smart is that? No, but think of it. Here's a guy who's very savvy. I know him very well. But here's a guy that says, you know, I'm going to declare a big portion of Ukraine independent. He used the word independent. And we're going to go out and we're going to go in and we're going to help keep peace.
But as the world now sadly knows, Putin did not keep the peace, as former President Trump predicted. Instead, he waged all-out war on a democratic nation. This puts Trump at odds with even most Republican leaders. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, the top Republican in Congress, said on Thursday that President Biden should increase sanctions against Russia all the way up after Moscow began a full-scale military invasion of Ukraine. San Diego Congresswoman Sarah Jacobs, a Democrat, also issued a statement strongly condemning Russia, urging strong sanctions, continued diplomatic efforts, and a lifting of the refugee cap to admit Ukrainian refugees. Around the world, protesters have flocked to the streets of major cities to protest Russia's actions. Thousands of courageous Russian citizens marched in the streets of Moscow and St. Petersburg, where Russian police made mass arrests of dissidents. Many nations and cities lit up landmarks in Ukraine's national colors, blue and yellow, to show solidarity. That includes the Empire State Building in New York, the Brandenburg Gate in Berlin, and the Paris City Hall in France. Locally, protests were held in Balboa Park in San Diego and in Santee, where a Ukrainian church is slated to be built. The Ukraine House in Balboa Park has put a link on its website to the National Bank of Ukraine, which has set up an online fundraising drive to support the Ukrainian armed forces. Though the U.S. and NATO countries have made clear they will not send troops to defend Ukraine, a non-NATO nation, against Russia, a nuclear-armed superpower, weapons have been provided to help the Ukrainians fight back. Hundreds of thousands of Ukrainian citizens have formed a resistance, many armed with semi-automatic weapons. Over 150,000 have been distributed to ordinary citizens. Ukrainians have also been searching online for instructions on how to make Molotov cocktails or improvised explosive devices. Now, in the fog of war, it's often hard to discern facts from propaganda, but though Russian forces far outnumber Ukraine's, there are some reports of successes for the Ukrainians. Ukraine's ambassador reports one Russian brigade surrendered when ordered to fire on Ukrainians, a people with whom many Russians have family ties. There are reports that an airport captured by Russia has been retaken and video purporting to show a tank blown up. Ukraine's top general reports that one soldier volunteered to lay mines on a bridge to prevent Russian troops from crossing into the Ukraine from the Crimea, but when he realized there wasn't enough time for him to retreat to safety, he opted to blow up the bridge and sacrifice his own life in hopes of saving his homeland. The unprovoked war has also sparked a humanitarian crisis, with thousands fleeing to neighboring countries in Europe. some of whom may ultimately be granted asylum in European nations and the United States, including the San Diego region, where many Ukrainian immigrants already reside, watching and worrying about the fate of friends and family members as the Russian bombardment continues. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery. And now here's the latest update on the Ukrainian situation from Public News Service.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Peace on our continent has been shattered. We now have war in Europe on a scale and of a type we thought belonged to history.
NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg condemned Russia's invasion of Ukraine, saying more NATO troops are moving into Eastern European member states to deter further Russian aggression. The UN Security Council will vote today on a resolution condemning Russia's invasion and calling for an immediate and unconditional troop withdrawal. At the White House, President Biden announced new economic sanctions on Russia and warned it was too early to call the situation a new Cold War.
There is a complete rupture right now in U.S.-Russian relations if they continue on this path that they're on. And in terms of a Cold War, that depends. You have the vast majority of the rest of the world in total opposition to what he's doing.
The president said the U.S. would cut off Russia's largest banks and largest companies from the Western financial markets and would restrict exports of technology to Moscow. Vice President Kamala Harris called the invasion a war of choice.
It is unprovoked, it is unwarranted, and it is unjustified. As the president made clear from the beginning, if Russia were to take aggressive action against Ukraine, our response would be swift and certain, and that is in fact what has occurred.
Approximately 7,000 U.S. soldiers will deploy to Germany in response to the invasion, top military officials confirmed. Former president of International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, Dr. Ira Helfand, warned a war could lead to the use of nuclear weapons. Both NATO and Russia have provisions for the use of nuclear weapons in their military doctrines.
If we escalate to the use of nuclear weapons, it is not likely that a single bomb would be used on a single city on each side. Rather, it's more likely that many cities in each country would be attacked with many nuclear weapons.
Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, Jan Egeland, urged world leaders to consider the humanitarian cost of war and said hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians will be displaced.
The story is the civilian suffering. The people who are engulfed by this fighting, who are in crossfire, are to a large extent elderly people.
Putin's invasion has also upended global markets, and experts say it will likely spike commodities prices linked to metals, grains, and energy products, and worsen inflation. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
This is John Tidwell with a crime alert from the San Diego County Sheriff's Department. The Sheriff's Department is asking for public help to find a kidnapped 6-year-old girl from Spring Valley. On Tuesday afternoon, February 22nd, around 1:15, Jolene Gutierrez was taken from Kempton Elementary School in Spring Valley. According to the Sheriff's Department, she is believed to have been abducted by her mother, Wendy Gutierrez, who does not have custody. Jolene Gutierrez is Hispanic, 3 feet tall, with long brown hair and brown eyes. She was last seen wearing a pink or purple sweater. Wendy Gutierrez is a 45-year-old Hispanic woman who is 5 feet 4 inches tall. She weighs about 120 pounds with bright blue hair and brown eyes. They were last seen around 4 p.m. Tuesday near East Plaza Boulevard and South Harbison Avenue in National City. If you have seen Jolene and Wendy Gutierrez or know where they are, please call 911.
The rules for staying on Medi-Cal are expected to change this summer, and millions could lose health coverage if they don't stay on top of the paperwork, according to a new report from Georgetown University. The federal government is expected to declare the end of the public health emergency in July, which will trigger an end to the requirement that all states provide continuous coverage for all people on Medicaid, or Medi-Cal as it is known here. Kristen Golden Testa with the Children's Partnership says the state will start to redetermine everyone's eligibility as their renewal dates come up.
Over the last 2.5 years, people have moved even within the state. And so the Medicaid program may not know where they are. And so they'll send the renewal packet to their last address. And if they don't get a response because the family's not there, they may be disenrolled. So it's super important that everybody update their address with the Medicaid program.
People can contact the Medi-Cal specialists at their county offices to request an address change. Many families who may now make too much to qualify for Medi-Cal will be eligible for state-subsidized health plans under Covered California. Professor Tricia Brooks with Georgetown University says states need to clear out their backlogs now and make every attempt to track people down before dropping their health coverage.
States should also enhance processes to follow up with enrollees via multiple communication modes when action is required to avoid a loss of coverage.
The report estimates that as many as 6.7 million children nationwide are at risk of losing coverage. Medi-Cal serves 14 million Californians, including 5 million children. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
At its February 23rd meeting, a reduced Santee City Council shot down a proposal to build yet another gas station under the ARCO brand, along with a car wash and mini mart on property near the junction of State Routes 125 and 52 on Mission Gorge Road. With 2 members absent, the vote was 2-1 to deny the project. Mayor John Minto was attending a meeting at the League of California Cities, and Councilwoman Laura Koval was working at her day job at Padre Dam Municipal Water District, according to the city clerk. The project included granting the applicant, Royal Share LLC, variances or exceptions from city requirements, including reduced parking, reduced setbacks, and traffic flows. Santee's development staff had found that the variances were justified because of the parcel's unusual size and shape. The triangle-shaped parcel is about 3/4 acre, where Royal Share already operates a car wash. The parcel abuts an existing gas station and mini-mart called Quick Corner. Owned by the Cherry family, the business has a history of litigation against the owner of the triangle parcel, who is identified by his attorney as Joe Colosio. That's the father of former El Cajon City Councilman Ben Colosio, who has a long history of litigation locally, both as a plaintiff and defendant. The most sensational of his extensive legal conflicts involves some former winners of a beauty contest he and his wife ran several years ago. In 2017, several winners of the Miss Middle East beauty pageant alleged they were denied cash prizes and that Colosio and his wife defamed them using social media after pressing their claims and sexually harassed them. In 2020, Ben Colosio resigned from the El Cajon Council after he and his wife settled with 3 of the plaintiffs for $300,000. But they didn't settle with Lena Cherry, an attorney who pursued her defamation claim. In their testimony at Wednesday's public hearing in Santee, Cherry and her brother Sam said their family business has sued Ben Colosio over his car wash customers supposedly blasting through their gas station and demolishing the property. If the city of Santee allowed the proposed new gas station, it would hurt not only Quick Corner, but other similar businesses nearby, the Cherries and other people at the hearing said. Within a mile of the Colosio business, there are 5 other gas stations, including one across the street at 7-Eleven, and at least 4 other convenience stores. Sam Cherry testified that his family had an agreement with ARCO to build a similar designed complex on their land, but once the pandemic hit, it was all pushed to the side. Councilman McNellis said he was an ardent supporter of small businesses and increased competition, especially for gasoline, but there were so many variances needed for this project it gave him heartburn. "Sorry, I don't see the need for it," McNellis said. Councilman Dustin Trotter seconded the motion to deny the permit. Councilman Hall said the project has generated far too many disputes, adding, "It's a lawsuit waiting to happen," but he voted against McNellis' motion to deny the permit. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, in the heart of San Diego's East County.
When trauma hits, It can come in the blink of an eye and can turn your life around like a tornado in a matter of seconds. Most do not know the steps to move forward from a crisis event, but locally there are some kind-hearted people who volunteer to be by the side of victims. In collaboration with the Emergency Response System, Trauma Intervention Programs of San Diego, or TIP, provides immediate crisis intervention after a tragedy. Specially trained TIP volunteers provide care and support to citizens who have been traumatized or are in a state of crisis, providing service 365 days a year. Imagine witnessing a fatal car accident or having a loved one unexpectedly die. TIP volunteers will be requested by emergency responders to be by your side to help process what has impacted you and help you with the next steps. Last year, TIP served over 4,000 people in San Diego County. TIP volunteers are called by local police, fire, medical, and hospital personnel to respond to scenes of sudden or unexpected death from all causes, industrial accidents, sexual assaults, violent crimes, and other traumatic incidents to provide immediate emotional and practical support to families, friends, witnesses, and victims. Now, TIP is seeking compassionate individuals who have an aspiration to give back to their community. If you would like to consider becoming a TIP volunteer, you can sign up for the next training academy, which will be held on March 2nd in La Mesa. To register for the training or to get more information, you can visit tipsandiego.org or call 855-TIP-SD-HELP. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Tidwell.
This is going to be our weather report, and I think that you folks in the Midwest and back east are going to really like this one, because you're always complaining that out here you just don't see a change of the seasons. Well, a late winter storm brought rain that we need a lot, and it brought it across a lot of the county this week, but it also brought heavy snowfall to Mount Laguna and lighter amounts of snowfall to elevations a little bit lower like Campo, Descanso, Lake Morena, and Uncompa. The snowstorms caused traffic snarls Wednesday on Interstate 8 in East County, and there were at least 10 semi-trucks that got stuck until a snowplow cleared the road. This is according to the California Highway Patrol. Heavy snow shut down Sunrise Highway, portions of State Routes 78 and 79, and some other roadways out here in the mountains, while chains were required for motorists in some of these areas. So, as of Wednesday, over 14 inches of snow have blanketed Mount Laguna. That's at an elevation of 6,000 feet. Palomar Mountain has 7 inches, and Julian has 3 inches so far. Some of our rural communities out here also had snow covering the ground. That included Lake Morena with 2 inches, Descanso and Guatay with 1 inch, and there was even a half inch in Campo. Along with that, many areas also received significant rainfall, like Pine Valley. They got over 2.4 inches of rain as of Wednesday. Some of the other communities got between 1.7 and 1.9 inches, including Santa Isabel, Lake Cuyamaca, Mesa Grande, and Descanso. But of course, you know, the students enjoyed one or more snow days because there were multiple school districts that closed schools because of icy road conditions. And that was including Julian's High School and Elementary Districts, Mountain Empire Unified School District, and Spencer Valley School District. Well, our Sheriff's Department has issued a reminder for you visitors that public parking in the mountain areas are limited, and access routes will be shut down if parking fills up and we end up with a snow jam. Mountain community members up here are asking that you visitors, if you come up to enjoy the snow after the storm is over, please don't litter. Enjoy the snow. And reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Marie Johnson.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is John Tidwell with a Green Scene Report. Imagine swimming beneath waterfalls alongside fish in a freshwater lake. That dream is all part of the ambitious plans that Lakeside River Park Conservancy has announced for a new park at Channel Road in Lakeside. Work began on the park in 2004 with the creation of a new entrance near Channel Road. The process was slowed by the recession, but now the organization is fundraising to move forward. In a newsletter to members, the Lakeside River Park Conservancy states, "We are planning a huge freshwater swimming lake. We always knew we would build a community pool because Lakeside is hot and our community needs one. This lake will take community pools to the next level with waterfalls and fish, adding, get your snorkel out. Plans also include a 5-acre children's play area with spaces for different age levels, each with its own water feature. To protect children's safety, the play area will be fenced and gated, with children only allowed to leave with their parents. In the past 20 years, the Conservancy has completed a 100-acre restoration of the San Diego River in Lakeside, including 2 miles of trails, with native vegetation providing shade to make trails usable year-round. The Conservancy also recently completed an 80-acre restoration in El Monte Valley and built a mile-long trail there. For more information, you can visit lakesideriverpark.org.
After revelations that San Francisco police used DNA collected from rape kits to charge a rape victim with a property crime, San Francisco's district attorney dismissed the charges and called the police actions a violation of the Fourth Amendment, which prohibits unreasonable searches and seizures. So East County Magazine asked the San Diego Sheriff's Department whether it has submitted rape victims' DNA collected at hospitals to a database that could be used to link rape victims to other crimes. Within hours of our request, Lieutenant Amber Baggs, the Sheriff's Media Relations Director, sent this response. "No, we do not do this. I read the article as well and checked with our crime lab director. We do not match victims' DNA to other crimes." A spokesperson for San Diego's district attorney has also assured that the DA has never received a request from any local law enforcement agency to prosecute a rape victim for another crime based on DNA obtained from a rape kit. In the San Francisco case, the DNA had been collected from a rape victim back in 2016, stored and used to recently charge her with a 2021 crime, the San Francisco Chronicle reported. Ironically, media has been unable to determine whether police ever caught or held the rapist accountable in the crime they were supposed to investigate. Rachel Marshall, a spokesperson for San Francisco's district attorney, has said that the DA there did not know that police used rape victims' DNA to solve other crimes until the office reviewed paperwork in the recent case. Marshall told National Public Radio, "This is illegal," adding that after learning that the procedure is routine for San Francisco's police department, the DA is working to end the practice. Marshall added, "It is our top priority to ensure that we are not dissuading survivors from coming forward or creating additional barriers to report rapes." San Francisco's DA is now working with State Senator Scott Wiener and local leaders to introduce legislation that would prohibit DNA evidence from a victim's rape kit from being used for anything other than investigating that crime. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Marie Johnson.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
The state's new Vehicle Miles Traveled Law, or VMT, seeks to reduce greenhouse gases by requiring fees from developers for projects that result in vehicles traveling farther than the regional average. Projects where drivers travel 15% fewer miles than the regional average, such as infill developments near roads, jobs, and transit, can be built without costly studies and mitigation soon to be required of other projects. Local jurisdictions are mandated to comply with the state law, but have some flexibility. So by a 3-2 vote, San Diego County supervisors recently voted to try and balance local housing needs with the state's goal of reducing greenhouse gas emissions in a two-phase approach. The first phase is short-term, to firm up within 6 months the definition of infill areas in unincorporated communities where housing developments could be built without triggering BMT study and mitigation requirements. Phase two is a long-range plan. Staff must return to the board in 4 months with a sustainable land use framework that could lead to an update of the county general plan to unlock vast parts of the unincorporated areas where development may be stymied by the state's VMT requirements. Supervisors' action applies only to the county's unincorporated areas, not to local cities. The three supervisors who now have substantial unincorporated areas in their districts split their votes, with Chair Nathan Fletcher in favor, but Supervisors Joel Anderson and Jim Desmond opposed. Fletcher noted that adopting a vehicle miles traveled, or VMT, policy is mandatory under state law, but he said, "The opportunity in front of us is to accept that we have to tackle climate change and we have to build housing, and look for the most legally viable way in which we can put the housing in the right places, meet our climate goals, and build more housing than we have ever built before." According to Fletcher, the plan greenlights and exempts over 4,000 housing units from VMT costs, and also allows affordable housing to be built without VMT costs anywhere in the unincorporated areas. Fletcher predicts the plan will drive unprecedented residential development in areas poised for near-term growth, while putting the county on a path to establish a long-term VMT mitigation strategy to ensure continued housing development in unincorporated areas. While Supervisor Anderson agrees with the goal of making it easier to build homes, during the board discussion, he called the county's estimates of homes the plan would allow disingenuous. He cited two properties in Spring Valley, one a vacant lot, the other with a house on it that would have to be destroyed to build up to 15 units. But there's no incentive for a property owner to do so, Anderson said. He asked how many lots in the proposal already have homes on them, but staff had no answer. Anderson said the plan isn't real, then opined that it was easier 60 years ago going to the moon than building homes in San Diego today. Anderson ran on a platform of making it easier to build homes and prevent the next generation from having to move outside the region. He said, "Everyone on this board wants a path forward so we can have generational wealth for minorities, but that this won't happen by talking and never building." When the vote was called, Anderson responded, "Sadly, no." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Elijah McKee.
As part of Children's Dental Health Month, dentists are asking California parents to be actively involved as their kids learn how to brush their teeth. By the third grade, 22% of children in California have untreated tooth decay, according to the California Department of Health. So, Dr. Aaron Shaw, a pediatric dentist in the Bay Area, recommends kids use an electric toothbrush with a timer.
We really encourage a child to work on developing the brushing skill, and morning's a great time for them to work on that. And then have an adult physically help with brushing and flossing at night so that the child can go to bed with really, really clean teeth.
A new study shows a greater risk of COVID complications in people with gum disease. And experts from UnitedHealthcare note that kids who grind their teeth may benefit from a night guard. Shaw recommends babies get their first oral health checkup at 12 to 18 months of age so the parents can get counseling on brushing technique and diet.
Having that early visit gives us the chance to get ahead of things so that we're being proactive and preventive rather than reactive.
The California Dental Association praised Governor Gavin Newsom's January budget proposal because it would increase funding to train more people in the dental field, expand Medi-Cal, and sustain a recent increase in the rates paid to dental providers. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
California State University Chancellor Joseph Castro has resigned from his post, effective immediately, over accusations that he mishandled sexual assault and workplace intimidation claims against a former colleague while president of Fresno State University. Castro had just completed his first year as the first Mexican-American chancellor of the nation's largest four-year public university system. He submitted his resignation to the Cal State Board of Trustees on February 18th, Cal Matters reports. CSU's governing body met behind closed doors the entire day, debating his fate. In a written statement, Castro said, "The decision to resign is the most difficult of my professional life. While I disagree with many aspects of recent media reports and the ensuing commentary, it has become clear to me that resigning at this time is necessary so that the CSU can maintain its focus squarely on its educational mission and the impactful work yet to be done." The fallout stems from a February bombshell expose by USA Today, reporting that Castro was personally aware of at least 7 complaints against Frank Lamas, the head of campus student affairs at Fresno State. The complaints against Lamas detailed a pattern of alleged sexual harassment of women, inappropriate touching, intimidation, and retaliation against workers, USA Today reported. Those complaints spanned the 6 years he was on the job. Despite knowledge of the allegations, Castro still recommended Lamas for an achievement award and later, rather than firing or calling for his resignation, paid him $260,000 and full retirement benefits to leave his post. The settlement forbade Lamas from ever working again at the Cal State system, but promised him a letter of recommendation if he wanted to work at a different college. 3 weeks after the settlement, the Cal State Board of Trustees formally hired Castro as the next chancellor, overseeing 23 CSU system campuses starting in January 2021. USA Today also reported that Castro said he conferred with then-Chancellor Timothy White on how to proceed with Lamas. The report said both Castro and White agreed paying Lamas off was easier than enduring a potentially expensive legal fight with him. Lamas told USA Today that he denied all allegations of wrongdoing. At least 2 Cal State campus presidents have said Castro should have acted much sooner. Adele De La Torre, president of San Diego State University, confirmed that gender-based harassment must be immediately reported to the Title IX officer. She called Castro's decision to step down the right choice. Castro's resignation follows student protests on multiple campuses, as well as calls for him to resign from some lawmakers and faculty members. Executive Vice Chancellor and Chief Financial Officer Steve Relier will take over as acting chancellor until an interim chancellor has been named. Cal State policy indicates that Castro is entitled to about $400,000 in compensation for the next year, and although he resigned as chancellor, he is entitled to a full professor position at the Cal State system, CalMatters reports. At the upcoming March meeting, the Board of Trustees plans to vote to bring on an outside group that will conduct a system-wide assessment to improve CSU's Title IX and civil rights training. But the CSU faculty union says review is insufficient. In a statement issued after Castro's resignation, the faculty union states, "Only a public, open, and independent investigation by the state legislature can produce impartial results, which can lead to the systemic changes we need to see." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Elijah McKee.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
Next up, we're going to share one of our best of East County favorites, taking you on the road to the historic Gold Rush town of Julian.
We're on the road in East County, visiting some amazing towns and meeting some incredible people across our region. Welcome to another adventure on East County Magazine's On the Road.
This is Miriam Raftery.
And this is Leon Thompson. Today we're on the road in Julian, California, a historic gold rush town in the mountains of East County, San Diego.
Now back in 1870, the town was founded by Drury Bailey and his cousin, Mike Julian. The two cousins were Confederate soldiers during the Civil War, both taken prisoner by the Yankees. After they got out and the war ended, they found their homeland had been laid waste by General Sherman's march to the sea, so they and other family members decided to head west. But Drury missed the boat to Panama, so he went overland instead. He did some hard rock mining in Montana, but then he ran out of money. So he flagged down a wagon train, and by a fortunate stroke of fate, he found that his brother was the driver. Drury founded the town of Julian in 1870 and named it after his cousin, Michael Julian. Traumatized by the war, Drury wanted to help others start new lives, so he gave away plots of land to anyone who agreed to build a home right away, as well as giving plots away for a school, a church, a jail, a town hall, and a chamber of commerce. Now, it wasn't hard to convince people to move to this remote mountain town, since that same year, Julian resident Fred Coleman reportedly paused to give his mule some water and discovered gold in what is now known as Coleman Creek, and the Julian Gold Rush was on.
Today, we've brought along our team of interns to tell you about the hidden treasures in this town of Julian, California, where you can relive the Gold Rush days nearly a century and a half ago.
Hello, this is Trevor Hill, and I'm here with historian David Lewis. Thank you for being here, David.
You're welcome. Thank you.
So I'm just going to ask you a few questions about Julian. First, I wanted to know, who are the people who founded the town?
Basically, Drury Bailey and Mike Julian were the only people who were really
involved in the town. Dury had homesteaded all this land, and then in 1870, when the major hard rock mines were discovered, that's when he hired a surveyor to lay out the town. So that's when I say it started, was February of 1870.
Who was Fred Coleman?
Fred Coleman is a black man that was in the area way before Julian was founded. We have him on San Diego County tax rolls in 1863, which is kind of interesting. That's when two the major battles of the Civil War took place. So it's right in the middle of the Civil War. So what's Fred doing here at that time period is interesting by itself. We don't have any answers to that. We probably never will. But Fred, he was apparently, according to local lore, had cattle here. He was friendly with the local Indians. We know that because he eventually married an Indian woman, Maria Jesus Anejo. Fred was apparently out looking after his cattle and stopped to water his horse in a creek. Again, this is local lore. They really expand on it sometimes, telling that he took his frying pan out of his saddle bags and all this, but we don't know any of this. We just know that Fred was the guy that discovered the gold. Apparently, Fred couldn't keep a secret, because pretty quick there were a bunch of people panning in that creek. And that was placer gold, the can you do pan for in water in a creek. But it didn't last very long. And so then they started working their way up the creek to find the source of the gold. And that's when they found it in these hills north of town.
And how did the discovery of that gold change Julian?
Well, Julian didn't even exist when that gold was discovered. So that was like the launch point for everything that happened around here. When word got back that they had found successful mine workings up here, and the first loads of ore ended up downtown on display and taken up to San Francisco for milling and assaying, that launched Julian.
Wow. Do you have any colorful stories that you've heard about the gold rush or just Julian in general?
There's lots of colorful stories. But I'm the historian for the cemetery, too, and people always ask me who the most interesting person from Julian that's buried in that cemetery, and it's Dury Bailey, the man that founded this town. Because when he founded this town, he went and he fought in the Civil War right after he got out of high school. Terrible deal. The family lost all of their land back there, and they end up here. And Dury homesteads all this land, and then, like I say, gets that surveyor. Dury's 26 years old when he did this. I find that pretty amazing because I was still looking for some gas for my car and hoping for a date when I was 26 years old, and this man starts a town. He made a pretty good reputation for himself as being a generous person, but he also had a lot of foresight.
Interesting. Can you tell us about this building that we're in right now, the Pioneer History Museum?
This building started out life. It was built by Joseph Treschel, who was a blacksmith, and he ran it for a few years. This was in the 1890s, and then he sold it, or leased it, I'm not sure which, to Peter Meyerhofer, who brewed beer here. And then it went back to another blacksmith, Christian Grosskopf, who blacksmithed here, and that was the last thing that I know that happened in here. It fell to ruin. All that was left are these rock walls in here. Wow. And in 1952, the Women's Club took it upon themselves to get some county money and some volunteers, and they rebuilt what you see here.
Wow.
So there's been a little expansion out the front, and we're doing a little expansion out the south end right now. But
so these are the original stone walls that we're seeing around
those
us?
Those right there, yes. And
wow.
Those were probably mined right here on site. That's Julian Schist. S-C-H-I-S-T, just to clarify that. Anyway, that is what is unique to this Julian area, and it's the quartz within that schist where the gold is found. So when they flattened this area out, they were cutting that stuff off, and it comes off in slabs because it's sedimentary,
mm-hmm.
and it's hard, mm-hmm. and then it's stackable. That's how these walls came about, was right from what was here.
Wow.
How often can you do that anymore?
Do you have any favorite exhibits here at the museum?
Well, probably my favorite is the Bailey exhibit because I almost feel like family. I know as much or probably more than a lot of the family does about them because that's been my focus. It has a few personal things in there, but my favorite one is that pic that's exhibited in there. It's not necessarily a pic that you would use for mining ore. It's for picking out samples. And he was injured in the mine in 1899, disappeared from the logbook for a while on the payroll. Mm-hmm. And when he came back, he had fashioned that pic as a cane also.
Wow.
So it's a little short, you might know.
Had a hunch, maybe.
Not Drury. Drury, this is the giant founder of the town, is 5'3" tall. So I've got a little picture that I did once. I photoshopped him in, me and my documentation, right? I photoshopped him in next to me and put a ruler between us just to show the difference of what we look like.
Wow. Thank you so much for answering my questions.
You're very welcome.
Anyone can come here and talk to David on Sundays you're here?
I'm usually here off and on. Okay. Lately, I've been able to get Drury's grandson, Richard Bailey. Anybody that comes up here can talk to the grandson of the founder of the town.
I have one more question. When did the mine close, the Julian Mines?
All in varying stages. There was no real just shutdown. People kept piddling around. Mm-hmm. They're still out there piddling around.
Wow, really?
Yeah. You know, especially when times get hard. People are out there trying to get lucky. But say from 1900, they were pretty much done. But then my grandfather's draft record shows he was a hoist operator at the Golden Chariot, and that would have been about 1918. Now we mine tourists.
Well, okay. Thank you again.
You're welcome.
Up next, we're going to have Jaden Jimenez tell us about what he found most interesting about the museum here.
While I was looking through the museum, one of the more interesting things that I found was a railroad spring. It was on a railroad cart. And what they did is they got the spring and put it in the Victorian Town Hall here in Julian. And basically, it was for the dance floor. So when there was large groups of people, they would dance and it would actually really add a springy effect. So I thought that was pretty interesting. One of the only spring floors left is actually in the Hotel del Coronado.
Wow, that's so interesting. Thank you, Jaden.
What do you think, guys? How would you like to go try your hand at some gold mining?
I'm feeling lucky.
All right, let's go.
This is Devon Marshall, and we're here at the Eagle Mine in Julian, which is open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to mid to late afternoon or so if you want to tour the mine or try your hand at panning for gold. Now I'm going to be talking to Mr. Craig Nelson, whose family owns and operates the mines, and with Kim Gordon, one of our guides today.
My grandpa, he ran this from about the late 60s all the way till he passed away. Then my dad took over, and then he passed away about 10 years ago. And then me and my brothers that took over, and we're really blessed to have a grandpa that decided not to dig the gold out of the mountain, because that's a lot harder of a job. Taking you folks through that mountain and teaching the history is a lot harder.
So then the real goal is the tourism.
Well, the education.
Okay.
I'll tell you, because the tourists that come to Julian, California, and I always, I'll tell you, the local town museum down there, which is Mr. Lewis,
right,
and those folks, and we just did Kim did a nice seminar down here at the library the other night, and you know, a lot of the kids don't realize what it takes to gold mine back in the 1870s and how they just barely made a living with this type of method. And they all want keyboards and phones and, you know, the technology of today. They don't pick up the pick and shovel and right, you know, do 8, 10, 12-hour shifts under hard rock mining. And that's what we want to show you is it's hard to get a guy to do that kind of work anymore.
So Steven, one of our interns, is here, and he's going to try his hand at some of the panning for gold. Can you come over and give him a couple of pointers on how to do this?
You want the sand to go over the rigid. That's why they make the tools. It's black to keep the metals separated. You can see the colors.
Uh-huh.
So like you said, you scrape to the bottom. Now what I do, once you get it in a pan, I settle it, shake it. Because then you get control of the sand by settling the gold to the bottom of the pan. Then when you get to the gold to the bottom of the pan, you simply let the pan and the water do the work for you, because that's what it's made to do. But you know what the first gold pan used to be back in the 1800s? The gold horn. We got a gold horn in there, so what they did is cut the end of the horns off. It's a U shape, right? You scrape it down into the stream, and you rock it back and forth. The gold being heavy stays in the metal. Unfortunately, I'm not going to go cut some horn off of a steer or something like that and get the end of the horn. Take this pan, and then once you settle the gold and you're happy with it, then you just let the water in the pan wash the sand out, because the gold is heavier and it goes to the bottom.
Okay, so we have Steven over here who's been trying his hand at it.
Devin,
what's his yield?
Come tell us how it's going.
It's been going good. I found myself a lot of good. And the techniques that Kim,
our favorite tour guide, one of our friends and family.
It actually works.
Yeah, look
now,
at all that.
What you want to do is concentrate. We want to see what you got as a collective. Get it all to the end of the pan, concentrate it by tapping it. Keep water in the pan. And then it separates, just like up at the mill. The sand will always go first, and the gold, being the heaviest, will drag out of the back with the black, that's the iron, separates by the metal like the mill up there. And you tap it, and you start rolling it. And the gold being heavier, we're going to chase the gold tail, as they call it. And look at how it comes and drags out the back. So now doesn't that look prettier? The
now
way that
talking.
You could look at it like that.
Eureka!
Eureka! your gold strike. So that's what you get. That's about $10, $12 worth of a gold tail right there. Now we're going to start at the Eagle Adit, because instead of an entrance to the gold mine, they call them adits, A-D-I-T. It's a puzzle.
What could we expect when we go down to do the mine tour?
Well, what we're going to expect is we're going to go over to the entrance, and we're going to learn how do you know where to start your tunnel? Because they couldn't pan for gold with the streams drying up. So we're going to go over the mountain. We're going to look at the way that the layers and the mountain structured. And we're going to show you how they go into the mountain and abstract the gold-bearing ore, the quartz, out of the mountain. You just learned how to get the gold out of the quartz by the California 5 stand mill. Now remember, that machine would operate right on that foundation right there. And we moved it up there when my grandpa made this a tour business. That way you had two-stage tour area right there. And once you move 22 tons, you don't move it back as you go. So we're going to show you how they go through that mountain and pull out the gold-bearing ore, and you already seen how to process it. So let's go see how we can get that quartz, the gold-bearing ore, out of the mountain.
Okay, we can send our interns down into the mine. You guys ready?
Oh, yeah.
All right.
We're going to cover.
Bye.
Yeah. Well, it's nice knowing you. We'll see you in about 50 years of being abandoned on the mountain.
This is Leon, and we're down in Julian, California, and our interns are back. How did it go on the mine shaft?
Oh, well, it was really great. We got to learn a lot of stuff, and it was really interesting, you know, learning the history. One of the coolest things that I thought that happened while we were in the mine is while we were in, you know, all the lights are on, you can see, you know, decently well, but he took us to this room where there was a candle, and he turned off all the lights, all of the lights to light up the mine, and it was complete darkness. There's no light source coming in whatsoever. And so we lit the candle so we could see how, you know, the old miners used to see just such dim light, and they had to deal with this for 10 hours a day. And so, yeah.
My favorite part of the mine tour was seeing all the gadgets that the miners used back then. And one gadget in particular was the Widowmaker, which was a nomadic drill. It was created to carve deeper into the cave. The nomadic drill would drill into the rocks, and then they would put dynamite in the holes, and the dynamite would explode, causing a lot of dust to affect the lungs of the miners, causing them to have lung cancer. And that's why they call it the Widowmaker.
Well, my favorite part of the tour was we got to this point in the mine where there was a shaft that went straight down for 425 feet, and our tour guide showed us the bucket that they used to pull ore up from the mine, and it turns out that they also used it as an elevator. And there was this huge steam-powered machine that cranked the rope, because it's such a long drop, you can't really have people trusted to hoist someone up that far. And there was a bell on the machine that was so loud, and it was to give signals. Different amounts of rings meant different things. And it was so loud, and it echoed throughout the entire mine, and I just thought it was really cool.
So what do you think? So how would you guys have liked to make your living as a hard rock miner?
I'll leave that to the old-timey miner people.
Tough work, huh? Well, I bet you guys have worked up an appetite.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, walking all over town, going down the mine. All right, well, let's go find something wonderful to eat. And there's no shortage of great places to eat up here in Julian.
Especially if you're looking for apple pie. Because Julian's goal these days is the tourists that come here to enjoy this wonderful town. Let's go eat!
This is Jaden Jimenez with East County Magazine, and I'm here with Charles Scott. He works at Candied Apples and here in Julian, so can you tell us a little bit about history about Candied Apples in Julian?
You bet, yes. My name's Charles. I'm the pastry chef and owner of the Candied Apple Pastry Company in Julian. We've been here for 11 years. Julian's kind of got a very interesting history with apples. It started with the gold miners who settled in this community in the late 1800s. They found that they could grow apples very easy here. In the early 1900s, they sent a bushel of apples to one of the world expos and won a gold medal. And that put Julian on the map for apples. Of course, supply and economics changed the world of apples up here a little bit. As Julian grew, some of the apple farms were turned into housing developments, wineries, and of course some of the apple growers retired. But there's still quite a lot of apples being grown up here, from a range of apple cider apples to you-pick apples to organic apples.
And apple pies.
And apple pie. Yeah, the apple pie history actually goes back probably to the Farmer family. Bud Farmer was an apple grower up here, and his wife used to make apple pies. This is dating back probably 40 years. As they handed off the business, Liz Smothers from the Julian Pie Company and Anita Knowles from Mom's took that over and kept the apple pie business alive up here in Julian and have kept that name quite alive. Of course, the Julian Pie Company, that works very well. Our little bakery is a European bakery and bistro concept. Of course, being in Julian, you have to make apple pie. So we do make apple pie.
Yeah,
along with many other things like 12 kinds of breads. I have a 7-year-old sourdough starter started in the French way from a white wine yeast. We do pastries, desserts, wedding cakes, catering, full service lunch menu, and of course, French crepes.
Wow. How did you get started with this store?
With this store? Well, this store was a transition from 35 years of hard work. I started in the industry as a young boy doing dishes. Got promoted to cooking because I said I didn't want to do dishes anymore. Worked my way through the industry, some fine hotels. Did my formal training in New York at the International Pastry Arts Center. Ended up in Borrego Springs as the executive chef of a hotel there. And in there at La Casa del Zorro. And in the process of them closing down and selling out, this bakery was on the market, and I chose to buy it 8 years ago.
Wow, that's wonderful.
And it's been 8 years of quite the wild ride of producing delicious desserts, pastries, breads, wedding cakes, birthday cakes.
So can you tell us a little bit about the community here? I know earlier you were talking about how so many people come in.
Julian's, I mean, it's like I said, it's got a very diverse history. Today, Julian has really put itself on the map as a tourist community. Anybody who comes to San Diego, is part of the program is to see Julian, hear the history of Julian. I've met people from all parts of the world, the Far East, the Mideast, quite a few European travelers, Sweden, Germany, Italian, and of course America. I mean, I've met people from all over the world who come in the bakery here. It's very fun.
Wow, that's really interesting. Thank you for interviewing with us. This is great. We're going to enjoy this delicious lunch. Got a few sandwiches and crepes. A
couple of paninis and some crepes. You bet. Thank you for joining us.
Candied apples. We're looking forward to trying those.
For dessert. There we go. You got to save room for dessert. Life is uncertain. Save room for dessert.
Thank you.
So we'll be back soon with another edition of On the Road in East County. We're signing off from Julian, California.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show. This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, AK Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.